Okay, we are ready to start, and today is October 5th, 2013. Okay, so we start with the salutation to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we're taking sutta number 109 in the Middle Length Discourses. This is the discourse on the full moon night. Okay, so this sutta, it's concerned with many aspects of the five aggregates, and so it's a very important sutta. Okay, so the sutta takes place when the Buddha was living at the city of Savatthi in the eastern park, not Jeta's Grove. But this is eastern park, it's called the palace, or actually it's the mansion built by a woman named Visakha, who is also known as Megara's mother. And so the sutta takes place on the full moon day, or full moon night. It's the Uposatha day. And so on this day, the Buddha is sitting out in the open, surrounded by the monks. And then one monk gets up from his seat, and he salutes the Buddha. He asks permission to ask some questions of the Buddha. And the Buddha says he can do so. Okay, and so the monk begins by asking whether these are the five aggregates here it's translated, the five aggregates affected by clinging. And then he enumerates them, the material form aggregate affected by clinging, the feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, the aggregate of sankharas, which we'll come to, and the consciousness aggregate. Okay, I want to write the Pali word and then just give a little explanation, because even the original term presents a little bit of a puzzle. Okay, so the term is Panchupadana Khanda. And this is a compound made up of the word pancha, which means five, plus upadana, meaning clinging, and khanda, which usually is translated aggregates, but the sense of khanda from various usages, it can mean things like a heap, a mass, an accumulation. Okay, and so we have five of these, and the question is, what is the relation of clinging to the five upadana khandas? We say that the five aggregates are here translated affected by clinging, so I use in more recent translations the five aggregates subject to clinging. The way I would understand this is that these are the five factors that make up the, let's say, the five constituents of experience, or the five constituents of the human individual, which are subject to clinging. The five types of phenomena that are the objective domain of clinging. And clinging is a attitude of holding onto. And the way I usually understand it in terms of the holding takes place in two ways. One way is what I call appropriation, which means, appropriation means making one's property. So you can see that there's a connection, the verbal connection between the word property and appropriate. So to appropriate something means you make it your property. And so clinging operates in regard to the five aggregates by taking hold of them and making them one's property. And when one makes them one's property, it means one conceives them as mine, that which I own, that which I possess, that which over which, and when you own something, you have you generally control over it. So the idea of the five aggregates as being mine suggests that I have control over them. And to have control means that you can mold them and shape them in any way you want, simply by a dictate of volition of the will. The other implication of holding or clinging to the five aggregates, I said one is appropriation, the other is identification, which means one takes something to be I, to be what I really am, and then with building that up a little more theoretically, then one takes the object of identification to be myself. This is the atta, the atman, the true innermost personal identity. And so the five aggregates, now the panchupadana khanda, the five aggregates of clinging, we could say are the five objects of appropriation and the five objects of identification. Or put very briefly and concisely, they are the five things that one takes to be mine, I, and myself. Okay, so now the monk enumerates the five aggregates And we'll come to a more extensive explanation of them a little bit down below. And then the Buddha approves of his enumeration. And then the monk asks, in what are these five aggregates affected by clinging rooted? And then the Buddha says that these five aggregates affected by clinging are rooted in desire. And here the word used is not tanha, but chanda. So it's a synonym of tanha or craving. So the sutta itself doesn't give any explanation of what exactly what's meant by saying that the five aggregates are rooted in desire. But we might understand it maybe in two ways. One way is based on maybe the Buddha's teaching of dependent origination, paticca samuppada, which implies that these five aggregates come into being, or they arise at the moment of conception, the first moment of a new life. They come into being because of the desire, the force of desire that's been moving on from the previous life. That is when a being is in the process of dying. As long as in the stream of consciousness of that person or being who is dying, as long as there is desire or craving accompanied by ignorance, then that craving, you know, when the life force is extinguished in the old body, the dying body, then the craving can no longer hold on to those five aggregates because now they've perished, no more vitality. But that craving becomes the seed for bringing into existence a new set of five aggregates at the moment of conception in the new life. So it's the desire or craving backed up by ignorance that gives rise to a new set of five aggregates which come into being at the moment of conception, and then they start to develop, mature, evolve until the being takes birth into the world and then starts to grow and mature. And all of this is taking place because of that impulse of desire that had been transmitted from the old life to start the new life. So that's one way to understand how the five aggregates are rooted in desire. And then the other way is simply to see the relationship between desire and the five aggregates in terms of the present life, that it's desire which is constantly sort of motivating us, which means to motivate or move the five aggregates to engage in various activities in order to try to satisfy desire. Okay, now the monk asks the Buddha still another question. And this is a very subtle, very tricky question. So he says, is that clinging the same as these five aggregates affected by clinging? Or is the clinging something apart from, something separate from the five aggregates affected by clinging. Okay, then the Buddha, well, first let's just take a look at the question. But maybe first we'll take a look at the answer. Okay, so on the next page, 888, the Buddha says, "Monk, that clinging is neither the same as these five aggregates affected by clinging, nor is the clinging something apart from, separate from, removed from the five aggregates affected by clinging. But it is the desire and lust, or the desire and attachment in regard to the five aggregates affected by clinging, that is the clinging there, that is the clinging to them." Okay, now, if you see the expression panchupadana khanda, and we just translate it very literally, the five clinging aggregates, then one might get the impression that the five aggregates themselves are all necessarily activities of clinging. So one would think, okay, even the physical body is an activity of clinging. Any kind of feeling is an activity of clinging. Any kind of perception is an activity of clinging. Any kind of volitional formations, any kind of consciousness. In that case, with clinging the same as the five aggregates, then the five aggregates become just expressions of clinging. But that's an alternative that the Buddha rejects. He says that's not the case. And if one says that there's clinging apart from the five aggregates, where is it? Floating around up in the ceiling? Is this my clinging? Maybe it's hiding in the flask, and when I open it, it jumps out and attaches to the five aggregates. Or maybe these five aggregates will be sitting in my room reading a book while my clinging goes out and takes a walk around the monastery. So that's not possible, is it? So the clinging has to be someplace within the five aggregates. And so where do we find it? The Buddha says, it is the desire and lust in regard to the five aggregates affected by clinging, that is the clinging there. And so the way we understand this is that it is the clinging consists in this desire and lust, which are just different names for the, again, for the mental factor of craving or greed, that craving within the five aggregates, among the five aggregates, that is the clinging to them. And in the five aggregates, where do we find that desire and lust? Where does it exist? In the five aggregates. It's in one of the aggregates.
Feeling?
Somebody said volitional formations. Should we do a vote? And somebody, did I hear somebody say consciousness? Okay, we'll put these.
How many votes for feeling? Three. Four? How many for consciousness? One, two, three.
No.
It's cheating. How many for volitional formations? One, two, three, four, five, six. I get everybody. For volitional formations, put the hands up high so I don't want them. One, two, three, four, five, six. There are only 13 people today, but... But I count 18 people. Who didn't vote? Raise your hands.
There's something called the Fifth Amendment.
Maybe somebody thinks bodily form should be the clinging. No? Perception? Johnny votes for perception.
Well, it may be interesting that ask for which is not. Some of us may just want to rule out one rule, the same as multiple rule, actually.
Okay, let's see where Bhante votes. That would seem to mean that if I'm feeling a pleasant feeling, that's clinging. Yeah, but it would seem that feeling is an object of clinging, right? If I'm feeling a pleasant feeling, it's not necessarily the case that I have to be clinging to it. What about the Buddha? He says that I live happily. So when he's feeling pleasure, then it would mean that he was having clinging. So it couldn't be feeling. Let's see, if it were consciousness with our same as clinging. Those who propose consciousness, are you saying every state of consciousness is a state of clinging? Who voted for consciousness? Nobody. Well, it would mean either some states of consciousness are states of clinging and some are not, or every state of consciousness is a state of clinging. If every state of consciousness is a state of clinging, then there couldn't be arahats because they're conscious. Well, if there were, they would have to be unconscious all the time. They would have to go into like a deep coma, and then you could say, okay, he's an arahat. But it doesn't sound very attractive, right? So certainly we could rule out the position that all consciousness is clinging. But some states of consciousness, some not. So which states are states of clinging? No clarification. So let's go to the aggregate of volitional formations.
There's three votes from the internet vote for volition formation.
Excuse me?
There are three people vote for volition formation from the internet.
Oh, okay, so you increase the number to nine. And any interneters vote for the others?
No.
Okay. Now the volitional formations is a very wide group, if you remember. And so it includes wholesome factors, you know, states of faith, mindfulness, samadhi, wisdom, generosity, loving kindness, compassion. Do you think those would qualify as clinging? Remember, clinging is the desire and lust within the five aggregates. So, is Sandy, you're shaking your head, yes? So you think the good mental qualities like generosity, mindfulness, samadhi, faith, that they're clinging? Well, clinging is desire and lust, attachment.
It's a good desire or it's a bad desire?
Well, this is the bad desire.
It's not
what? Okay, now we have unwholesome mental factors also. What are some of the unwholesome mental factors? Greed, hatred, delusion, wrong views, conceit, laziness, restlessness. Maybe we'll find clinging there. How many think clinging will be found in the wholesome mental factors? And how many think clinging will be found in the unwholesome mental factors? Great majority. And my Pali expert here is not voting at all today. Okay, the volition, the I'm going to boost the number up to 10. I have to cast my vote. And here we have wholesome, neutral, and unwholesome. Certainly will agree with the unwholesome vote. And amongst the unwholesome factors, we have one of them is greed. And so it's greed that is the actual force behind clinging. And then greed goes very closely in clinging, it goes very closely with wrong views. Because when there is the attachment to the five aggregates, then one gives rise to the view of the aggregates as being mine, I, and myself. Okay, so this is coming back now to that definition. It is the desire and lust in regard to the five aggregates subject to clinging, that is the clinging there. So the desire and lust, these are just two terms for the mental factor of greed or craving, and those exist in the aggregate of volitional formations or volitional activities, and they take as their object any of the five aggregates. Okay, at this point, do they have to hit the...
We just have to make an offer. This is the first day of the...
Yeah, I know, yeah. Okay, are there any questions now at this point? Okay, Jim has a question.
that you mentioned it before. When the being passing away,
yeah.
At the moment of passing away, then we try to the clinging to because of the clinging and ignorance, then it's looking forward to try to grasp the existence.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the next life.
Yeah.
Formed.
Yeah.
Where is that clinging? Is this on the consciousness stream, or where?
Where is that clinging?
You know, where is the clinging during the time? Because the consciousness is the form.
Yeah.
The perception.
Yeah. The question is actually not very clearly raised within the old texts, the Nikayas, except in one sutta. It's a little sutta that comes in the Samyutta Nikaya. Let me see if I can remember where it is. I think it's Abhyakata Samyutta, which is chapter 44 in the Samyutta Nikaya. And it's not dealt with in any kind. It's just like one statement there, and I don't even remember the exact words. But so my understanding, I just explain my understanding, that what happens, say if the person, if it's a human being passing away who's going to take a human rebirth, that a very subtle type of five aggregates after the person passes away. So then the stream of consciousness exists in the form of a kind of subtle, very subtle type of five aggregates, that they're still existing in a kind of ethereal state. Because it's not necessarily the case that all of the karmic conditions conducive to a new birth will be present at the exact moment that the being passes away. And so this is based, my understanding of this is based on some accounts that I've read in the literature of people who have recollection of their past lives, not through a meditative experience, but just in some cases the recollection occurs to them spontaneously. Often it's in the case of people who had died suddenly in youth, either in childhood or in youth. And so for some reason, because the consciousness maybe is strong at the time of their death, so some kind of memory carries over to the next life. And so they're able to describe what happened when they passed away, and they see they see themselves maybe as as they died, they see themselves sort of detaching from the physical body and floating around the room. And even looking down at their body lying dead on the deathbed, and they see the relatives gathering around and weeping. In one account that I read, the person who had died was trying to make contact with his relatives, but nobody paid any attention to him, except the family dog was barking. So the dog could sense the presence of some other being in the room, but not the human people. Okay, so I think the being then remains in this kind of, you call it a disembodied state, but there's a very subtle type of ethereal matter present, so they still see their bodies, and they still have a sense of themselves as continuing their old identity. And so they'll be, and then they can move, they don't have a clear sense of the passage of time, whether it's one day or one year, they don't have a clear sense of that. They find themselves able to move over great distances of space very quickly. And then at some point they find themselves attracted to a particular couple, drawn to a particular couple. And then they'll hang around the house until the man and the woman have sexual relationship. And then at that moment, then they lose the sense of continuous consciousness until they find themselves coming out from the womb. And then as they regain, you know, as they mature in their new identity, then they have some memory comes back to them of what happened at the end of the previous life and in that intermediate period. Does that answer the question?
First part.
Yes.
Second part. How about arahat?
Yeah, for an arahat, there's no continuity of the consciousness beyond death.
The subtle five aggregates.
Yeah.
What are the main part that we both there, right? Which one would be the main part that triggers the beings to take the form of the movie? Are they volitional formation, or are they components, or are they mixed?
Yeah, what would lead back to the human realm would be the karmic accumulations that are conducive to a human life. And so the karma would be coming out of the aggregate of volitional formations, because chaitanya volition is the main factor amongst the volitional formations. Okay, Suki has a question. I'm not really hearing very well. Maybe put the microphone closer to me.
You ask questions about where clinging is, like feeling consciousness and volitional formation, and everybody body.
Yeah.
And I didn't exactly hear your answer.
You didn't understand my answer.
Right.
I didn't hear it well.
Right.
Okay, the answer is that clinging is the mental factor of greed or craving, which is one of the unwholesome mental factors in the aggregate of volitional formations.
Oh, that I understand. So, I thought none of those because of the five aggregates. When you are, you don't have clinging, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a matter of which part of the five aggregates there is a clinging.
Yeah.
It's a matter of what state. So you could, all of those could have clinging if you're not arahant.
No,
like,
no. Because that would mean that the five aggregates, that clinging is the five aggregates themselves. What's true is that all five aggregates can become objects of clinging. That's why it's called the five aggregates affected by clinging, or the five aggregates subject to clinging. Because one clings to form, one clings to feeling, one clings to perception, one clings to volitions themselves, one clings to consciousness. So all five are objects of clinging, but the clinging itself is a factor or a couple of factors in the aggregate of volitional activities. Okay, I think we should go on now. Okay, so now the monk asks the Buddha whether there can be diversity in the desire and lust regarding these five aggregates. And so the Buddha says there can be, and he says, here someone thinks thus, may my material form be such and such in the future, may my feeling be such and such, perception, may my volitional formations, may my consciousness be such and such in the future. And so in this way, there is diversity in the desire and lust regarding the five aggregates affected by clinging. So this means that the diversity comes because there are five aggregates. Maybe at least we could say there are two ways there can be diversity. First, because the five aggregates themselves are diverse or different. So one can wish for one aggregate to be different, form or feeling or perception, the formations or consciousness. So because the five aggregates are different, when one wishes them to change, each one to change in a particular way, then that is one aspect of the diversity. The second aspect is that one can wish for any of the aggregates to be different in a variety of ways. Now I'm a man, so I might wish, say in the future, maybe in a future life, may I become a woman in the future. Or I might wish, may I be Chinese in the future. May I be Thai in the future. May I be Mexican in the future. May I be French in the future. So I can wish for a whole variety of ways. May I have blue eyes, or may I have blonde hair, blue eyes and blonde hair in the future. Or may I have black hair and almond-shaped eyes, brown almond-shaped eyes. For feeling, may I experience these kinds of pleasant feelings, those kinds of pleasant feelings. May I have these kinds of perceptions and ideas in the future, and so on. So there's many different ways of hoping and wishing for one to take shape in the future, or to undergo particular experiences in the future. Okay, so in this way there is diversity in the desire and lust regarding the five aggregates. Okay, now we come to a major question, and that is, in what way does the term aggregates apply to the five aggregates? Okay, so now we're really going to hit on the meaning of what exactly is the reference of these five terms that are used to designate the five aggregates. Okay, so the Buddha says here, any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the material form aggregate. And similarly, any kind of feeling, any kind of perception, any kind of mental or volitional formations, any kind of consciousness, whether past, present, or future, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the consciousness aggregate. So here, actually, the Buddha is using a wider concept simply than the aggregates subject to clinging, but taking all the aggregates, whether they're subject to clinging or not. And so at this point, to get a fuller idea of what's entailed by each of these definitions, you could take up the chart or table that I gave out the other day, or that I prepared the other day and that was given out this morning. Actually, I sent it out the other day. And so here we draw upon a number of other suttas which sort of fill out the reference or denotation of the five aggregates. And so we start with the aggregate of form. And then there is a sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya 22.79 which explains the names of the five aggregates. So it explains the aggregate of form, which is rupa, in terms of another verb which originally has nothing to do with the word rupa. But there's a kind of wordplay involved here. The verb is rupati. The word rupati means to be injured, to be assaulted, to be molested, to be to undergo decay. And so the sutta uses that as a basis for a wordplay. So it says, because it is rupati, because it's subject to assault, or it's subject to attack, it's called rupa, form. Is the sound of that vehicle outside? Can the people in the back hear my voice okay? Okay, so this is the wordplay. So the text says that rupati, it is, and I tried to capture that wordplay by using the word deformed as a basis for the word form. So it is deformed, therefore it is called form. Then they said, by what is it deformed? It's deformed by heat, by cold, by the sun, by wind, by flies, mosquitoes, the bites of animals, and so on. So therefore it's called form. So that is a wordplay, but sort of more precisely, when the suttas are explaining the content of the aggregate of form, they explain form as the four great elements and the form derived from or based on the four great elements. So what are the four great elements? Yeah, earth, water, fire, and wind or air. So those are the four primary elements, which according to the Buddha's philosophical position, represent four modes of matter, or four, if you call it, four modes of behavior of matter. So from the philosophical angle, the earth element is the aspect of solidity, which is manifest as differing degrees of hardness and softness in material substances. The water element is the element of, maybe you could say, liquidity, with the property of flowing. And it's said that the water element is responsible for the binding together of the particles of matter. Then the fire element is the aspect of heat, the factor that gives some kind of temperature to all material substances. So even when something is cold, when we feel something is cold, it still has some degree of heat, because there's some, well, we would say today, there's some motion of the molecules, and so that is what is generating the heat, even if it's 100 degrees below zero. But the fact that there is some degree of heat there is the presence of the fire element. And then the air element is considered the force of matter responsible for expansion and contraction, or for motion. Okay, so those are the four primary elements, and then based on those, there are varieties of other material phenomena. So the texts speak about, in the form aggregate, color, sound, odor, taste, tactile sensations, the different organs of the body, the sense faculties of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and bodily sensitivity, and so on. Those are all aspects of form that's derived from the primary elements. Okay, then we come to the feeling aggregate. And so this includes all types of feeling. And then the sutta that gives the derivations of the names of the aggregates explains vedana, or feeling, on the basis of the verb vedayati, or vedayati. It feels. That which feels is feeling. And then it says, what does it feel? It feels pleasure. It feels pain. It feels the neutral feeling, neither pain nor pleasure. And now when using the English word feeling to explain vedana, we have to be careful that that the word feeling here doesn't signify what we would call emotions. You know, like we say, oh, I'm feeling, oh, okay, see, he feels love for you, or he feels gratitude, or he feels thankful, or he feels neglect, I feel neglected by you, I feel despised by you. Okay, so in English we use the word feeling. Those types of feelings are not what is meant by vedana. But probably we would say that what we call emotion in English is a rather complex phenomena which has components from several of the aggregates. But rather feeling, in the sense of vedana, is the very simple, very basic way in which we experience something as being either pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. Some translators use the word sensation for vedana, but in my opinion that's too narrow, because we usually think of sensation as things that one experiences through the body. Like I have a tingling sensation, okay, in my foot, or a dizzy sensation in the head, or a sensation of maybe a butterfly-like sensation in my stomach, right? Do we use the word sensation in that way? What are some other sensations? Tingling, burning sensation, some other sensations, vibrating sensation. What other sensation can we think of? Throbbing sensation. Tingling, throbbing. Smooth sensation. But anyway, you can see that they're all pretty much bodily experiences. But if we look at now the definition of feeling in terms of its contents, we have six types of feeling. Feeling born of contact through the eye. through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body, through the mind. So if I say something nice, maybe I come driving along a road and then suddenly turn around a hill and then I can see a very beautiful landscape. So through the eye, I have a pleasant sensation, or rather I have a pleasant feeling. But I wouldn't call that a sensation when you get the feeling of pleasure by seeing something with the eye. Or if I'm listening to some very beautiful music, then I have a pleasant feeling through the ear. But unless if I have the headphone, and there's something wrong with the headphone and it's pressing against the ear, then I would say I'm getting a pressing sensation with my ear. But if the earphones are comfortable and I'm listening to the beautiful music, I don't think I would say I'm getting a really pleasant sensation from this music. Even though I have a pleasant feeling. Unless it's something like heavy metal rock, then I might get an unpleasant sensation as, you know, the ghost throbbing, bum, 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 bum. Right? But as far as the actual, you know, the way I respond to the music, that is a feeling, but I don't call that a sensation. Okay, so this is the aggregate of feeling. Then we have the aggregate of perception. And so this is explained, or the word sanya is derived very simply from the verb sanjanati. It perceives, and then that's filled out. What does it perceive? It perceives blue, yellow, red, white. Sometimes the word sanya is translated as idea or ideation, because this is an aspect of sanya. So I say that sanya covers a wide range. So when we have sanya, I would say, operating directly through the five physical senses in terms of sight, hearing, smell, and so on. In that case, I would call it perception. But when one is identifying one's perceptions, comparing them, classifying them, and so on, then sanya is turning from perception into ideation. And so we have, according to the contents, six classes of perception. That is perception of forms, sounds, odors, tastes, tactile objects. And then we have perception, this is called perception of dhammas, which we understand to be things that are apprehended solely by the mind without relying upon the physical senses. Maybe the ideas, or maybe the impressions come from the physical senses. For example, I'm sitting here in Zhuangyan Monastery in Carmel, New York, but I could think back to the Naga tree, remembering the Naga tree outside the hermitage where I used to live in Kandy in Sri Lanka. So I can see it with my mind's eye. And so I'm getting, it's like a visual impression, but since I'm entertaining it not with my eyes, but with my mind, then it's a dhamma apprehended by the mind. I even remember the fragrance of that tree. It was the most beautiful fragrance in the world, I think. And the interesting thing about the fragrance of the Na tree in Sri Lanka, one gets it early in the morning when one steps out of the cottage, out into the open, then one gets this, if there's a very light breeze, one gets this really exhilarating, wonderful fragrance. But then when one thinks, oh, that's so beautiful, so wonderful, and one sniffs trying to get it, it's gone. It's so subtle that you can only pick it up when you're not deliberately trying to get it. If you're thinking, ah, I want to get, you know, if clinging enters, I want to get that again, it's gone. But then when you relax and think, I missed it, and then one gives up, then suddenly it comes back. So I can remember all that, but I don't have that fragrance now because we don't have... Maybe we should plant some na trees around Zhuangyan Monastery. But I don't know if they'll grow outside the tropics. Okay, so this is the class, six classes of perception. The fourth aggregate is the Sankhara Khanda. And we translate this here as the aggregate of volitional formations. But different translators use many different renderings for sankharas. Like one other American monk, Venerable Thanissaro, he uses fabrications in the sense that they fabricate things. Some have used, in fact, I don't even use volitional formations now. I've changed it to volitional activities. And some have used compositional factors, constructive factors, confections. I think early 20th century British translators used confections. So now confections comes to mean sweets that are sold at a candy shop. Because they're things one prepares. Yeah, Venerable Jnanananda, a very intelligent Sri Lankan monk, living in Sri Lanka, he uses preparations. Okay, but the definition that's given, or the derivation given in the sutta is that they, it's this, this statement is very, very hard to translate accurately or meaningfully into English. What's said is that they can, if I use the word constructions, it would work well. They construct the constructed. Therefore, they are called constructions, or therefore they are called constructive activities. They construct the constructed, therefore they are called constructive activities. But here we use the connection between the terms and the definition is lost. They give form to the conditioned, thus they are called volitional formations. But the root idea here is that it is the sankharas that shape the human person, because it's the sankharas that generate karma, and it's the karma that gives form or shape to the other four aggregates. In fact, even it's the karma that gives shape also to the volitional activities themselves. So the sankharas shape all five aggregates, because it's through karmic activities that we acquire the particular five aggregates that make up our identity. And now when the sutta is explaining what's meant by the sankhara khanda, it uses a different word. It doesn't say there are these six classes of sankharas, but rather it says there are these six classes of chaitana. And chaitana is what we translate volition. And so the text says that there are six classes of volition. Volition regarding form, sounds, odors, tastes, tactile objects, and mental phenomena. So whenever we have any kind of volition, or we might say intention, in regarding any kind of object, that intention or volition constitutes the aggregate of sankharas, volitional activities. So for example, now I have the intention to take a sip out of this herb tea. So even within that general intention, there will take place a number of secondary intentions. So my first intention is the wish to drink the tea. But then how do I get that wish fulfilled? I don't just sit here and say, let me sip the tea, and the cup comes up to my lips and I sip it. But even without being fully aware of it, I have to make the intention to stretch out my arm. Then I have to make the intention to stop stretching out, because if I just continue like a drunk driver, stretching, 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 I'll knock the cup over and the tea will spill. So I stop, I have the intention, stop stretching. Then I have the intention, close the fingers, get a grip on the cup. So I have to intend to close my fingers around the cup. Then I have to also have the intention, stop the grip. Otherwise I'll keep on crushing, crushing, crushing. Well, I won't break the cup, it's too hard, but I'll hurt my hand. Okay, then I have to have the intention, pick up the cup, bring the cup to my lips, stop bringing the cup any closer, otherwise I'll just knock my head back like this. Then I have to have the intention, tilt the cup, open the mouth, take in the tea, taste it. Well, tasting is perception. And then the intention, swallow it. And yet usually when I'm sitting here and talking, or when you're doing any activity and maybe sipping or drinking some tea or coffee or soda on the side, you're doing all of this, not even aware of all of those intentions. But you can't have those intentions without being aware of them, right? Well, let's say you can't do those activities without having those intentions. But the intentions are taking place so fast that you don't even notice them. But this is one of the things that happens through training and mindfulness. When you undergo like a course in mindfulness meditation, you have to notice every little thing you're doing. So like normally we take a walk, you know, maybe walking around the path of the monastery, talking to a friend, and we're thinking, tomorrow I'm planning to do this, I'm going into New York, I have to do this, that, that. And before you know it, we've gotten from the top of the hill to the bottom of the hill, not aware of a single step. But when you're doing the mindfulness meditation, you have to be aware of lifting the foot, bringing it forward, putting it down, lifting the next foot, bringing it forward, putting it down. And then when you're doing that, you realize that whenever you're walking, what's going by very, very quickly are these intentions. So all of those are intentions belonging to the aggregate of volitional formations. But the most important volitions within this category are the volitions, what we call the ethically or morally significant volitions. That is the unwholesome volitions, volitions driven by greed, hatred, delusion, conceit, envy, jealousy, and so on. And the wholesome volitions, volitions motivated by generosity, kindness, compassion, humility, patience. Because it's those volitions the ethically significant volitions that create karma. And so it's in the aggregate of volitional activities that the Buddha locates the force responsible for, or the factor responsible for creating karma. And that factor is the factor of volition itself. Okay, then we come to the fifth aggregate, which is the aggregate of consciousness, vijnana. And the sutta derives the noun vijnana from the corresponding verb, which is vijanati. So vijanati is actually based on the simpler verb janati, which means to know, and it has a prefix vi, which sometimes gives a more specialized meaning to a verb, like special knowing. Yeah.
Is there any connection to the root of vision?
The root
vision.
The English word vision.
Yeah. That is Latin through.
I don't think so, because I think the root there would be something with V's. So it's not, but it's connected. Janati is etymologically connected with the English word knowledge, which you could see if you take the noun from janati, or actually you could see it even with vijnana, but let's say the noun here is jnana, which in Sanskrit is jnana. And you can see it with no. Even the silent K in English, it becomes silent. And the way they pronounce this word in Sanskrit, it comes out jnana. Though I think correctly it should be jnana. But I've heard it very often pronounced jnana. So you can see that that is where the etymological connection is. I think vision, the Pali word for visual verb to see is pasati. So there could be, from the root pas, there could be a connection that's not so clear between the root pas and vis, from which vision comes. Okay, so vijnana, you know, formal definitions like this are not found in the text, or what I would call conceptualized definitions that we're familiar with from like a textbook on psychology. But the way I understand vijnana, well, first let's before I give my explanation, let's see what the text says. Okay, when explaining the characteristic, it says simply, why is it called vijnana? It says vijanati. It knows, or it cognizes. What does it cognize? Then it says it cognizes sour, it cognizes bitter, it cognizes sweet. It cognizes salty. And now you notice, if you look at the derivation of perception, perception is explained just by distinguishing different types of colors, and consciousness is explained just by distinguishing different tastes. And so I sometimes say that if I were like a university philosophy professor, and the Buddha was one of my students, And I gave an exam question, what is the difference between perception and consciousness? And he submitted his answer. Well, perception perceives different colors, and consciousness cognizes different tastes. I'd have to say, sorry, Bhante, with all due respects. But I have to give you an F on your answer to that question. Because certainly it's not the case that perception applies only to colors. In fact, if you look at the other sutta, which says six classes of perception, there you are, perception of tastes. And if you look at the other sutta, which explains six classes of consciousness, there you are, eye consciousness. And what is consciousness knowing through eye consciousness? Certainly it's not knowing sour, bitter, sweet, and salty. So Venerable One, please go back and hand in a better paper tomorrow. So this is something of a puzzle. I don't know how to explain this. I like to think maybe some young monk got hold of the transmitted sutta and thought, God came up with a brilliant idea. And so he filled in his ideas into the sutta. Okay, so the way I understand the difference between perception and consciousness, that perception is what actually sort of fixes upon the different characteristics of things and identifies them, puts a label on them and sort of selects, separates, isolates, and then uses these labels and designations as a basis for memory, as a basis for conceptual classification. Whereas I understand vijnana, or consciousness, to be, maybe I would call it, the light of awareness, which arises based on each of these six sense bases, and it opens up that whole domain, up that entire objective domain that corresponds to the type of consciousness. So eye consciousness is awareness opening up based on the eye base or the eye faculty, which opens up all visible forms to awareness or to knowledge or to perception. Ear consciousness is that awareness that opens up based on the ear and that opens up all sounds to discernment or to knowledge, and so on with each of the other five senses. And mind consciousness is that kind of awareness that opens up the entire domain of ideas, concepts, judgments, images, projections, plans, desires, memories, that opens up all of those inner mental processes to cognition. Okay, at this point I could ask whether we have any questions on anything covered so far today. Stephen? I can hear you, though there's a little bit of competition.
Sorry, I was wondering if you could say a few more words about going back to Vedana, about the third quality of Vedana, neither
okay.
Pain nor pleasure, because I always wondered why it's typically rendered with this so Yeah. Raising as opposed to just saying neutral.
Okay, okay. He's asking why the third type of Vedana is rendered by this clumsy phrase, neither pleasant nor painful, neither painful nor pleasant, rather than simply calling it neutral feeling. I don't know why that particular, you know, label for it came to be. Maybe the purpose is simply to show that it's a feeling which is not pain, not pleasure. Though sometimes, if you were present for the Abhidhamma session, you weren't here for the Abhidhamma? Oh, I thought you were, I'm sorry. But the Abhidhamma uses another word, another term. It uses, which is a little confusing, it uses the expression upeka vedana, which upeka usually, normally means equanimity as a positive or beautiful mental factor, the state of mental balance. But in regard to feeling, it uses upeka to designate this neutral feeling. And some other, I think it's in the commentaries, that neither painful nor pleasant feeling is called mudjata vedana. Mudjata means madhyata, in the middle, the feeling in the middle. That would be the neutral. Okay, Richard?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. First, form. Why is rupa translated as form when the simile is a lump of foam and the characteristic is, you know, could be deep form, both of which sound like it's matter that can be switched into a number of different forms.
Yeah.
For instance,
yeah.
The condition is nutriment, so it's kind of like a bowl that's in your
throat. Yeah.
But it sounds to me like it has more to do with simply undifferentiated matter than with, you know, the shape applied.
Yeah, I know,
form,
I know.
Right?
Yeah.
What is there, why is form used? Right?
Yeah, okay, this is a good question. So the question is, why is the English word form used for rupa, whereas it seems from other aspects of the explanation that matter would be more precise. In fact, the way rupa is actually used, what you say is, in a sense, correct, that it's closer to matter, except that there's two ways in which the word rupa occurs. And I think maybe this explains the choice of form. That rupa is also used to designate the class of objects that correspond to the eye and that are apprehended by eye consciousness. And so it seems that rupa, the older meaning, was things that are seen. And then it came to be given an extended meaning to apply to everything that has some kind of, well, physical existence or material existence. And so some translators use the word matter. I used to use material form. I think I switch over to form for a very simple pragmatic reason, that in verse one sometimes gets nama rupa, and then if one wants to translate the verse with some kind of catchy beat to it or a rhythm, materiality sounds pretty awkward, but name and form, you could almost dance to it.
But the nama rupa is that's a direct translation, right, of name and form.
Yeah.
It's used for consciousness.
And what?
It's used for consciousness.
Well, name and form goes along
here.
With... Yeah.
Nama rupa, we have under condition for consciousness, you've got name and form.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, right...
Yeah.
And so that seems to imply is this like the Greek idea that the form of something is sort of transmissible through the air when you look at it?
No, not at all. I've not come across that idea in Indian literature.
Well, but, I mean, if it's particularly associated with vision, rather than other things, because for its under characteristic, you know, the consciousness, cognize uses a bunch of tastes.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas with that is perception just colors.
Yeah.
Right? And but you think, well, you've got to be able to cognize a color too, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's what I said, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Okay, now, yeah, I just wanted to come back to this expression, name and form. In this case, also, nama is not really name, just as rupa is not just form. But nama, of course, it's etymologically, it's related to the English word name, and probably that was the original sense. But it comes to mean, in the Buddhist literature, Buddhist text, it comes to mean the factors, the mental factors that arise together with consciousness and that are responsible for, let's say, different types of ways of particularizing the object. So nama includes feeling, so it's the way the object is, the tone with which one cognizes the object. It's perception, the way one designates or classifies the object. Nama includes volition, the way one responds to the object, the way one utilizes it, and so on. So name is not really, nama is not really name, and rupa is not really form, but simply that name and form sounds, you know, good together. And then one has to explain exactly what, to understand the term, there has to be some explanation of what's meant by name and form in this context. Okay, I think we're going to have to stop now with the sharing of the merits. Then we can come back after the lunch. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. Oh, today I have to go to New York, so we won't have a discussion period this after the lunch today. But if you have thought of questions about the sutta, what was covered so far that we couldn't take today, you can make a note of them, and then we'll bring them up next week after the class, next week. So next week we'll take the same sutta and continue and finish it. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. I'll do the shorter form of the second verse. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa chirang rakantu mang param. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhuting. Okay, please stand. And we end with 3 half-hours to Buddha. Even though he got his F on his aggregate exam, but still we have to pay respects to him. Okay.